This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Claudia Hammond and this is All in the Mind from BBC Radio 4 from November the 10th, 2020. And I'm here to look at how we think, feel and behave. Did you know that we start to lose our sense of humour from about the age of 23? But fear not, it's never too late to take action.
So one quick story, a new CEO of a large nonprofit in the United States was leading this all-hands call on Zoom, addressing all of the employees. And during that call, he was sharing his screen. When it was someone else's turn to speak, he pretended that he forgot that he was still screen sharing. And he went to Google and typed in things that inspirational CEOs say. And everyone lost it.
How humour can help us through the hard times. And many of us experience the benefits of getting out into nature. But is it the same if you've been prescribed to do it? We've got some intriguing new research on this. And my guest today is Daryl O'Connor, who's Professor of Psychology at the University of Leeds. Welcome back. What do you have for us?
Well, one of the studies we're going to talk about is exploring whether the amount you smile is in any way associated with health behaviours that you engage in.
Very curious, that one. I look forward to that. Now, before all that, can we psychologically inoculate ourselves against fake news? We all know now that there's plenty out there online that's not reliable. And psychologists know that inaccurate information not only travels faster, but can lodge itself more deeply into the mind than the truth. Fact-checking and myth-busting is great. I do plenty of that myself. But it can come too late once the lies have spread. In just a day, there's already plenty of misinformation out there about the latest COVID vaccine news. But at the University of Cambridge, psychologist Sander van der Linden has been trialling an online game called Go Viral that trains you to spot fake news by learning not how to tell what's true, but the techniques that people use to spread rumours and gain followers.
Yeah, so the idea behind Go Viral is to try to inoculate or immunize people against misinformation about COVID-19 specifically. And one of the things we did was we tried to look at the misinformation landscape and identify the techniques that are being used to dupe people when it comes to information about COVID-19. And we found that there were three specific levels that were really important here. And the first we called the fearmonger, which is about exploiting people's emotions, including outrage. The second is called My Imaginary Expert, which is about the use of fake experts to sell or peddle fake cures. And the third is about prominent conspiracy theories that have been surrounding COVID-19. And it's a five-minute game. And so over the course of 5 minutes, people move through these three levels and are exposed to weakened doses of these techniques in order to build up intellectual antibodies against them.
So what's clever is I just had a go and it sets you up as if you've got a social media account, as if you've got a kind of new account and you're trying to get likes and you're trying to get credibility, you're trying to be popular. It feels slightly transgressive to sort of be doing it at all. But luckily, none of this is real, is it? It's not going out there.
None of it is real. It's completely fictional. It's a controlled, simulated environment. And what we're trying to do is simulate the experience for people of what it's like to create misleading content as a way to learn how to recognize it in order to gain immunity against it.
And what's clever is you do include very specific techniques. And so there's things like it teaches you how to invent a fake expert, which I guess the idea is then that you start looking out for posts online that have somebody who is a fake expert, that you should be, if you're going to believe that, oh, Dr. So-and-so said this, you ought to check them out for yourself.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And just as with the regular vaccine, you know, it's not the case that you have broad scale immunity against anything. It targets specific antibodies. And so it's the same here. We're not kind of making people more skeptical about everything in the media. We're specifically training people to recognize these prevalent techniques, including the fake expert technique. And it takes various forms. You know, in the game, you might be impersonating a doctor of natural medicine and try to, you know, convince people of fake cures. And we kind of explain this technique behind borrowing somebody's credibility because they look like an expert and can gain an audience and influence people. And that's how, you know, a lot of these rumors about fake cures get started and circulate.
Now, you've developed this game based on your previous game, which you have tested on more people, and you've tested to see how long these effects last psychologically. What did you find? Does it work? Does it actually make a difference in real life?
Yeah, so we've done loads and loads of research now on some of our other interventions, including bad news. And what we find across, you know, many thousands of participants is that people do improve in their ability to spot these techniques and to be less influenced by them. So typically, we test people beforehand, then they play the intervention and we test them again. And in randomized experiments, we either assign people to our intervention, the game, or another game, for example, Tetris. And what we find is that typically on our outcome measures, people significantly improve in their ability to spot fake content in our game intervention. And of course, nothing happens in the Tetris control group.
I was really interested to see that after 3 months, the effect was still stronger if you had contacted people every week with some fake items and asked them to rate those. So if you'd stayed in contact and almost reminded of them a bit every week, a little booster every week, it made more of a difference than if you hadn't. But in practice, isn't that going to be quite hard to do?
Yeah, so what's really interesting about that longitudinal study is that, you know, initially we were following up with people week after week for months and kind of, you know, launching a misinformation attack in the sense of asking people to rate these fake items again, and we wanted to see how long the resistance lasts. And what was surprising is that it lasted, you know, still it lasted after 3 months, and then we thought, well, that's a bit unusual in the sense that, at least in psychology, we expect interventions to sort of taper off over time. And what we realized was that actually we might be giving people a booster shot by exposing them to some of the same items, which might motivate people to kind of remember the content that they've learned and to resist it. And so we did another experiment where we just followed up months later, but with no contact in between. And that's where we found that the effect actually wears off over time. And that made us think about the idea of booster shots, that, you know, just as sometimes you have to go back to the doctor to get another shot, in order for the effect to be maintained, people have to interact with either the game or the content or the follow-ups in some way in order to maintain the effect.
And this is really clever, but you're, of course, competing with millions of people on social media, some of whom are spreading misinformation. So how can you get this out to enough people? Because don't you need millions and millions of people to have a go at this, to be able to change their views, their way of using social media?
Yeah, absolutely. With Go Viral, we've received support from the World Health Organization and the United Nations, and they've created videos of the material and posted it to their 12 million followers, and the WHO has put it on their website, which has really helped scale this intervention beyond anything that we've done so far. And we hope that with that, we can reach enough people to, you know, have a real-world impact with these interventions.
Now, Daryl, there's new research just out from King's College London and reinforcing the need for work like Sander van der Linden's. And they looked at 6,000 people and what measures they were taking to protect themselves against COVID-19. And they looked at their social media use and their beliefs in conspiracies. So what did they find here?
So there's a number of really important findings, Claudia, in this study. And actually, one of the first things they found was that individuals who have more strong conspiracy theory beliefs about COVID-19 are actually less likely to engage in the health protective behaviours that we need to see people through this pandemic. And the other thing they also found was that, again, the same individuals, you know, if you've got high and strong beliefs about conspiracy theories to do with COVID-19, you're also more likely to find your information about COVID using social media channels. And the reason why that's concerning is because they're able to show, as I said already, these direct links, or these associations, I should say, between beliefs about conspiracy theories and also less likely using health protection, and then more likely to use social media.
So did that mean that the people who'd seen more social media and who believe more in conspiracy theories were less likely to keep their distance and less likely to do all the things that would keep them safe, or wash their hands, things like that?
That's exactly it. If you think of the government's current guidance on hands, face and space, so what these studies particularly showed was very clearly individuals who hold beliefs such as they believe the virus is caused by something probably created in a lab, or they believe that the symptoms of COVID are connected to 5G mobile network radiation. These are the sort of individuals who are less likely to, you're right, socially distance, wash their hands and engage in all the other government restrictions and guidelines that we need to engage in to stay safe. But what I should also say, Claudia, which is really interesting, is the fact that there is this differential effect observed between where you got your information from. So individuals who got their information from social media in terms of COVID-19, that's where the more damaging effects were shown. Whereas if you found your information from broadcast or print media, it seemed that the effects were not observable to the same extent.
So it shows how much it matters what you read. Thanks, Daryl. Now, last week, we were talking about how to cope with lockdown and other restrictions and how to get through the winter. There's new hope on the vaccine front, of course, but we know that doesn't change life right now or for some time. And lots of you emailed us at allinthemind@bbc.co.uk, or you tweeted me at Claudia Hammond with your tips. Now, Roger says he has avoided watching the news all day and instead gets his pandemic news from a few selected sites a couple of times a day, including the BBC's. And at the age of 75, he has worked out his own risk of dying, and that has made him feel a little bit better. And Chris Lee sent a list of 7 tips, which he's found useful last time and has blogged about for colleagues this time. And they include things like being purposeful, finding something creative to do, controlling what you can control in your life. And this one is interesting. If you're worried about something, he suggests postponing worrying about it until the weekend. Now, Daryl, there is evidence, isn't there, that setting aside a particular time to worry can be effective?
Absolutely. And indeed, our group in Leeds and elsewhere in the world have also been looking at this. Individuals who postpone worry, this yields really beneficial effects against the effects of worry. And indeed, what I try and do is worry each night, if I'm going to worry, at 7 until 7:15.
What about the archers, though? You clearly don't listen to it. You'd miss that then.
That's indeed right. But hey, I think it's better to look after my health than anything else.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Don't tell other Radio 4 listeners that. But coincidentally, there is a lovely animation on the All in the Mind website, if you scroll down a bit, which is called How to Manage Your Worries. And it features this exact technique of setting aside a time to worry. Now, in 2016, the American magazine The Nation ran an article headlined, "Have you ever seen Donald Trump laugh?" It pointed out that almost no one has. And in the last week, I guess he's not had so much to laugh about. Now, according to his niece, Mary Trump, who's a psychologist and the first member of the Trump clan to publish a biography of Donald Trump, her grandfather didn't laugh either, saying that if you laugh, you let your guard down. But are people who don't laugh missing out not only on fun, but on a tool to help with resilience? Jennifer Orker and Naomi Bagdonas are the authors of a book called Humour Seriously, and they argue that humour is seriously underrated, especially in the workplace. Now, in the course of their work, they've watched hours of stand-up, lucky them, interviewed comedians, trained in the world's best comedy institutions, and taught comedy at Stanford Business School. Now, did you laugh or smile yesterday? As Naomi told me, this was one of the questions in an extraordinary survey of 1.4 million people in 166 countries.
At 16, at 18, at 20, people are consistently saying yes. And then at age 23, people fall off a cliff. And that is, of course, when we all enter the workforce. So we go to work, we become serious and important people, and we have these misperceptions about humor, what it looks like in the workplace, what it can do for us, and those misperceptions hold us back from using it. And of course, what's important here is that if we spend 8 hours of our day, if we spend the majority of our waking hours at work, and we act a certain way, we leave our sense of humor at the door, then that seeps into everything else that we do. We stop laughing at home, we stop having the same sort of mindset around lightheartedness, and it can have really negative impacts.
23 is such a precise age for that to happen. That seems such a shame. That's so young as well. So do you think that people could introduce laughter into their workplaces? I mean, it's hard at the moment, obviously, because people are working from home so often and Zoom meetings aren't that funny.
Absolutely. One thing that we find, though, is that most people at work believe that they cannot use humor in ways that would actually advance their business goals or even, moving their team ahead, not to mention mitigating depression that we're often finding in these remote work settings. And so one of the most important things is to first understand what is holding us back. What are these misperceptions we have with humor? People either believe you're funny or not, which is untrue. It's something you can learn, just like how to use Zoom without muting yourself. And a second myth is just that humor is comedy, that if you're going to use humor, you have to be funny. But it's not about, you know, being a stand-up. It's about cultivating joy, not just cracking jokes.
I wonder if, in a way, people have already been using it during the pandemic. I mean, if you think about it, particularly during lockdown, there were all sorts of, you know, videos that went viral of things like sports commentators commentating on their dogs or unblocking their household drains. And those kind of things have gone viral. We're kind of trying to cheer ourselves up, aren't we?
Absolutely. This isn't just us, you know, laughing with each other and having a frivolous moment. This is really quite effective coping mechanism for people.
This must be particularly hard, though, Jennifer, if people are experiencing anxiety or depression, that the joy kind of goes.
But it's really remarkable when you shift a mindset to you have more control over how you approach things, but that has this exponential effect on others. So one quick story, Connor Demon-Yaman, who actually teaches our class with us, he's also a new CEO of a large nonprofit in the United States. And so last month, he was leading this all-hands call on Zoom. So it was a really important moment addressing all of his employees in a really hard and serious time. And during that call, he was sharing his screen. When it was someone else's turn to speak, he pretended that he forgot that he was still screen sharing. And he went to Google and typed in things that inspirational CEOs say. And everyone lost it. So it was this beautiful moment of levity and signaling vulnerability in this totally unexpected and funny way. It's just a great example of a small moment where if you do something like that, it diffuses tension and it immediately bonds people.
So we have a long winter to get through. In your research, have you found ways that people can deliberately add laughter to their lives? What can we do this winter to make it easier?
The first thing that we have our students do when they come into class is a humor audit, which is the most fun audit that anyone will be a part of. So don't be afraid of it. And we recommend that anyone can do this. A humor audit is simply going through your day and writing down the moments that you laughed or you made someone else laugh. And the reason that this is so powerful, it seems like such a small technique, but the reason it's so powerful is it leverages a principle in psychology called the priming effect, which has been shown that it's essentially a principle that shows we find what we set out to look for. So we as humans, if we are primed with a concept, we're more likely to find it. And by the way, when researchers do this, researchers have done something similar where they have people at the end of the day write down three of the funniest moments from the day. What they find is that not only after 7 days, but for up to 6 months, rates of depression are lower. People report being happier and also having more control over their lives. They report feeling more autonomy in their life. And so that's one little thing everyone can do today is start doing a humor audit for the next 7 days.
Naomi Bagdonis, and before that, Jennifer Orker. Daryl, I wonder whether you still laugh at work. I miss it not being in an office very much now.
Absolutely. I mean, our worlds have changed dramatically, and there are obviously lots of positives of working at home. But I agree, I also miss those interactions and fun chats in the corridor and over coffee with colleagues. Yes, indeed.
And now you've got a study for us, not on laughing, but on smiling. And weirdly, how the people who are smiliest in photos are more likely to go for health checkups and to look after their health generally. How on earth can those things be related?
I mean, I'm actually even smiling thinking about this particular study. So it's a really nice investigation. And what these colleagues at the University of California in Irvine did was they were trying to find a way of measuring people's happiness or positive mood. And one way of doing that was to look at the smiling in photographs. And the reason why this is interesting is because we know that when you tap what's called a genuine smile, it's called a Duchenne smile. And this is where the muscles in your face around your eyes actually activate that physiological response, which is associated with smiling intensity. And so what they were able to do was they got a large sample of individuals, and they were able to then, using a really clever way of coding smiles, and then look to see individuals who are smiling more, particularly using this more genuine Duchenne smile, and check, is this associated with the likelihood of these individuals seeking health protection or going to see their GP or physician in the United States?
But if they smile, you think perhaps these are happy, smiley people, and you think they might be so optimistic that they wouldn't think any bad ill health would ever befall them, and so they might not bother to look after their health as well.
Well, that's also very possible. But I suppose what's really nice about the study, it's been able to just compare for the first time The people who are more likely to smile as a measure of happiness and positivity with those who don't. And I think what's also, I think, neat about this investigation is that it's an objective outcome. So you can ask people, are you happy or did you go and see your GP or whatever the case might be? But this study is really nice because it does, for the first time, objectively assesses this happiness or smiling intensity.
And so what do you think the link is? Why do you think that the people who smile more, who are maybe happier, look after their health better?
Well, actually, I think what this is a marker for general happiness and positivity. And I think what's probably likely happening is that these individuals are much more likely to engage in better social relationships. It's possible having this overall tendency to be happy alters physiological functioning, which benefits health. But also a really important mechanism is likely to be individuals who are more positive in their outlook and measured through smiling in this context, have better health behaviours. So over their life course, it's likely they are more likely to engage in self-care.
Thanks, Daryl. Now, last week, we talked about awe walks, where you deliberately look around you for things to inspire awe and childlike wonder. Now, ever since, people have been sending me wonderful pictures they've taken on their awe walks. So thank you for those. I'm wondering whether receiving lovely pictures of walks is also good for your well-being. And Ron, whose surname is appropriately enough wild, emailed to say that since the first lockdown in March, he's deliberately done an awe walk every day. And at the same time, he's collected rubbish. So that involved awe and altruistic acts, which have also been shown to improve well-being. So I reckon that's a win-win there. And there are even green prescriptions where people with anxiety or depression are prescribed a certain amount of time in nature. Now, they sound like a great idea, but are they necessarily right for everyone? Matthew White, who's a senior scientist from the University of Vienna, is the author of a new study conducted with 18,000 people across 166 countries. And he told me just how many people are deliberately using nature to help themselves.
Well, the first thing to say, of that sample, about 17% reported taking depression or anxiety medication as recommended by a doctor. So about 2,700 people, which is roughly what we'd expect. What we were very surprised about is just how frequently nature was being used by these groups. I mean, it's well documented that people with certain anxiety disorders don't like to leave the house. And similarly, for people with depression, they often find it difficult to get motivated to get out. What we found was that people with depression use nature or visit nature just as often as people not on medication. And people with anxiety disorders actually spent more time in natural environments than people with no conditions, which really quite surprised us.
And did you know why people were doing it? Were some people with mental health problems deliberately going into nature in order to try to ease their anxiety, or more because they just found they liked it and felt the urge to do that?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. We don't actually have access to that data. But what we do find is that their emotional responses in terms of reductions of anxiety and increased positive emotions were particularly pronounced in times in nature. But the other thing that we were really quite surprised about was that the more people perceived social pressure from their friends and family to visit nature to help treat their symptoms, this seemed to undermine the intrinsic motivation. So people would go more if they felt pressured to do it, but they enjoyed it less and they had higher anxiety. So the message here for things like green prescriptions is quite clear. You can't just write a prescription for someone to say, come on, you need to get out there in nature, because that can undermine the intrinsic motivation to do so. You've really got to work carefully with someone to identify the places that are important and meaningful to them, support them access those, rather than just give a simple prescription.
And that's a shame, because green prescriptions sound like such a nice idea, and it's, you know, cheap and easy as long as people have got some nature that they can go to, and seems so sensible. Would there be a way then of doing those green prescriptions that didn't undermine the motivation? Is it all about the wording, even possibly not using the word prescription?
That's certainly possible. I think it's about supporting people access places that they find are good for them. For some of these people, of course, there might be a reverse causality issue here. The reason that they're getting pressured is because they're not intrinsically motivated in the first place. And I think we need to unpack that a little bit more. I think it's just important not to assume that everybody's going to benefit from everything.
Now, of course, for some people, getting outdoors into nature is difficult, maybe if they have mobility problems or there's nothing nearby that they can get to. And so you've also been looking at whether realistic virtual forms of nature could have an impact and maybe be a bit of a surrogate to the real thing when that's not possible.
Well, just to put this in context, we've actually been working with healthcare providers. But when we were speaking to various people working in hospitals and care homes, they said people are in here for a long time, they're getting bored, and that's having all kinds of negative effects on their mental health. So what we did here was a simulation study before we could do a real control trial, where we made people bored. And apologies to anyone out there who works in an office supply company, but there's a well-trialed stimulus where you listen to a guy talking for 4 minutes about his job working in an office supply company that has been shown in previous studies to really bore people. So we wanted to get people in a state of boredom, and then we wanted to see if contact with virtual nature could decrease the boredom and increase positive mood. And how we did this is we worked with producers of Blue Planet 2, which, of course, if anybody's seen it, is some sensational footage. But they also produced a 360 version where several of the cameras were put, for example, in the coral reefs, where this isn't obviously shown on the television, but there was 360 cameras, so you can have full immersive experience. So we had those two conditions. Either you watch Blue Planet 2, you either had this 360 version. And our third condition, we had people in full immersive virtual reality experience, where they were also in a very similar coral reef, where you could actually move your hands, you could move around with interactive headset and hand controls.
And what did you find when it came to well-being or mental health?
Well, some really amazing outcomes, actually. I mean, to cut a long story short, all three conditions improved mood. They all reduced boredom to, you know, very significant levels. But interestingly for us, and kind of what we expected, was the most immersive condition, the one where you could move physically, you could move your arms, and it meant something, you could touch, reach out to the turtle as it swam by, and this kind of stuff. That one produced the highest positive emotions, reduced negative mood the most. But that also increased the highest levels of marine connectedness. And the reason that happened was because you've obviously felt more present in the environment. People reported far more immersion in that full virtual reality. And we think marine connectedness is important, not only because of the mood implications, but because we found other research showing that, you know, higher connectedness to the marine environment, you're more likely to want to protect it in terms of, you know, disposing of plastics and this kind of thing. Now, we did this study before COVID happened, before an awful lot of people were bored for an awful lot of amount of the time. So we think that this kind of technology could really support people who are struggling during COVID times.
Could the virtual reality version, or just watching the film about nature, watching Blue Planet, could that be useful maybe for the people who aren't seeing the benefits from being given green prescriptions, because then they wouldn't have to go outside and maybe it wouldn't seem like a chore? Or would your guess be that, well, those people are just not so interested in the whole natural experience, so something else might be better for them?
Oh, that's a lovely idea. Imagine you had a whole suite of environments that they could visit and they get the choice rather than just the local park just around the corner, you know, three or four times a week. So I can imagine building a suite of options that people have choice over. And it's that choice that's probably key in terms of the benefits that could accrue. So, yeah, that's a lovely idea. I'd love to follow it up.
Well, I hope he gets his grant for that, and looking forward to hearing the results, Matthew White. And thank you very much to Daryl O'Connor from the University of Leeds for joining us today. And thanks to the producer, Adrian Washbourne, and our studio engineer, Sarah Hockley. We produce this All in the Mind podcast in association with the Open University. And have a look at the BBC's All in the Mind webpage for links to their work in mental health and social care. I'm Claudia Hammond, and in the next episode, I'll be asking whether hearing other people's stories of recovery can help those who experience psychosis, depression, or anxiety to recover faster themselves. Meanwhile, I'm off to do a humour audit. Bye for now.